Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. We are continuing our Journal Club series with Annals of Surgery, and today we are going to be discussing the paper Pre-Peritoneal Ventral Hernia Repair, a Decade-Long Prospective Observational Study. Today we are honored to have Dr. Todd Hanford, who is the Chief of GI and Minimally Invasive Surgery at Carolinas Medical Center. He's the Director of the Carolinas Hernia Institute, and a very well-known expert in the field of abdominal wall resection. We also have our guest today, Dr. Dana Tellum, who is the Associate Professor of Surgery and Director of the Comprehensive Hernia Program at the University of Michigan. Thank you for joining us, and welcome on Behind the Knife.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Karen Chabert chiming in. I'll just sort of give the summary for our listeners of what their paper found. So Dr. Hennifer's group at Carolina's Medical Center, they first described the preperitoneal ventral hernia technique in 2006, and they're now reporting on their 12-year experience with this repair in 1,023 patients. In their series, 69% of the hernias were recurrent, and 23% were incarcerated. About 40% required a component separation, and the average hernia size was about 210 centimeters squared, or 8 centimeters in diameter. The average mesh size was 800 square centimeters, or 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters. And 90% of cases used synthetic mesh. The use of biologic mesh was associated with worse outcomes and more frequent recurrence, as expected. Their median length of stay was 5 days, and 27% of patients had a wound complication, most often a seroma. The wound infection rate was 15%, and the mesh infection rate was 1.7%. Only 5% of hernias recurred over an average of 2 years follow-up. So all in all, they sound like very good results in challenging cases. And so Dr. Hennifer, could you start by walking us through your technique and just keeping in mind that our audience goes from medical students all the way up to department chairs?
Certainly. When I first started repairing hernias a long time ago, and no one ever grows up wanting to fix hernias, for gosh sakes, or even becomes a surgeon wanting to fix hernias, but we developed a real interest in it first in doing it laparoscopically. And then as the complexity of the cases that I began to see didn't fall into a laparoscopic realm, I started doing more and more open hernias. I was somewhat dissatisfied with the mesh overlap that I would get with a Reeve Stopa or retrorectus repair. Fantastic operation, and I think it should be the go-to move for the majority of open ventral hernia repairs. But what we began to see in our data is the more mesh overlap you were able to achieve, the lower the recurrence rate would be. It did not impact quality of life of the patient, nor did it impact complications associated with mesh, including infection. And so developing a preperitoneal space, I did it by accident in one case where I was going to do a stope repair. The peritoneum was fairly thick, got in the preperitoneal space, and then circumferentially just dissected the preperitoneal space well out laterally. Sutured it closed like you would a retrorectus repair or standard retrorectus repair, completely excluding the intestine. And then I just started mimicking that over and over again. This began a number of years ago. We first reported on this, it makes me feel old, but 2006. And we've subsequently continued to do that and defined and redefined the technique. The The way we typically will start and the way I typically train or teach residents and fellows in doing this is we'll start in the space of retius. Getting into the space of retius, most residents and fellows have done this before. If they stay, they will blindly place a balloon in that space to do a TEP inguinal hernia repair. They see that space over and over. So teaching someone from a known, something they know, and then expanding it into unknown, I find to be very helpful. We typically will start in the space of retius and then move out laterally in the preperitoneal space. You have to be careful that you're not actually taking down transversalis fascia. And those people who do a laparoscopic inguinal hernia repair will recognize if you're taking transversalis fascia down, you'll see the epigastric vessels, you'll see the rectus muscle fibers themselves. But if you stay low and then work your way along the pubis, avoiding the iliac vessels, and then coming laterally, you can get into the space much like when residents spend time doing a transplant or kidney transplant. Once you get in that space, I begin to start to peel the peritoneum back toward the wound. And going from lateral, where there's typically no scarring, and peeling the peritoneum back toward the wound over and over again, as you walk up the abdomen, you're able to peel the peritoneum all the way back to the midline. We take the falciform down, in most of our patients, and I think in this study, the average BMI in these patients was about 34, so they have a plentiful falciform. Use that as your preperitoneal space going even to the xiphoid and even above the xiphoid, and then repeat the maneuver on the other side. And after doing this a few times, our fellows and our residents really, they become... This becomes a kind of a known factor for them. Even patients who've had multiple previous surgeries and multiple failed hernias, what your abdomen tends to do is to reform peritoneum. And it's where it's truly peritoneum or kind of a mesothelial layer that looks like peritoneum. You know, your body wants to make this surface that your intestines can move against and freely move against. And so we just use that space over and over. We do various forms of this. Sometimes we take down a bit of the transversalis fascia laterally. The transversalis fascia behind the transversalis muscle and above the peritoneum is super thin. It's about as thin as peritoneum. So we'll move in and out of transversalis fascia, which really adds no strength to the abdomen, but adds strength to the peritoneum. And again, I tell my fellows all the time, I don't care what layer you're in out laterally, whether it's pre-transversalis fascia or pre-peritoneal, as long as you know what layer you're in, and we'll use that to our advantage.
And then once you dissect all the way out there, you place your mesh in the standard fashion. Is that how this works?
Yeah. And so once we've done the preperitoneal dissection, so once we get in the abdomen, once we get inside someone's abdomen, we'll only do adhesiolysis between the intestine and the peritoneum or the anterior abdominal wall. Unless someone has a history of bowel obstruction, I do no intra-loop adhesiolysis because that just increases your chance of enterotomy and increases your chance of complication. In patients who have a history of bowel obstruction not associated with their hernia, then we have to chase that. But once we get in, it's preperitoneal dissection, we will close the peritoneum with a running tool vicryl typically. You can close it from side to side. You can close it head to foot. And if you can't get the peritoneum completely back together again, we'll use a bit of omentum in the middle of this. Whip stitch the omentum. Essentially, what we're trying to do is exclude the intestine prior to placing our mesh. And your counts are correct. You've examined the operative field. You exclude the intestine. And then the operation becomes a lot more fun. You can get really wide overlap and choose any mesh that you want.
When deciding to do these operations, who is the patient that this is best suited for? And when do you go to the laparoscopic or different kind of more standard open approaches?
Yeah, so as far as laparoscopic versus open, we did a study that's actually published in Annals with you guys back in, I think, in 2013. Paul Calavita, who was a resident in our lab at the time, now is one of my partners, looked at open versus laparoscopic ventral hernia repair. And I've wandered through hernia repair. Sometimes you might think even perhaps with a CNI dog or something with how little I knew about this, we have discovered that doing a laparoscopic ventral hernia repair actually hurts more than open, but it does provide a reduced incidence of wound complications. Open sometimes is more cosmetic in that you can revise wounds and those sorts of things, but it has a higher chance of wound complications. But the recurrence rate for both of them is essentially equal. For standard ventral hernia, smaller ventral hernias, people who don't have skin complications or super thin skin overlying a hernia, then I describe this to the patient. I let the patient decide between open and laparoscopic ventral hernia repair. In patients who have thin skin, very large defects, wide defects that will require closure of their abdomen, if they want closure of their abdomen, laparoscopically, we can get the small defects closed. The larger defects, we can't close laparoscopically effectively or cosmetically. And so sometimes that will be a deciding factor for patients. They want their fascia closed. But the difference between the two, I let patients decide in small to moderate size hernias. And for the open patients, the majority of them are candidates for a preperitoneal hernia repair. I would say that indeed, probably 85 to 90% of the hernias that I do now, I will place my mesh in the preperitoneal space.
That pain is higher in the laparoscopic approach, but now with people using less of the tacks and some of like the glues that are available, is that still the case, or are we shifting towards laparoscopic also being less painful?
I think that's a terrific question, and you can bleed into this or blend into this, you know, laparoscopic, robotic, extraperitoneal mesh placement. Now, certainly in the standard laparoscopic approach where you place the mesh intraperitoneal plus or minus closing the fascia, you're going to need, for me, I'm going to need permanent fixation. You're going to use either permanent tacks or permanent sutures or both. If you use absorbable sutures and absorbable tacks, and again, it's a problem for us as surgeons that we don't have efficient and effective prospective data to tell us exactly what we should do. And we should all, I mean, honestly, we should be participating in studies like this. But I make a living, and I'll say it somewhat tongue in cheek, I make a living fixing failed hernias. So, you know, I don't know what the denominator is in this, but the numerator in patients who have absorbable materials or glue, when you're placing a mesh against the peritoneum, the failure rate, and I just see loads of failures in that. And again, I stand at the bottom of a funnel, and anecdotal experience is not data. I'll say it straight out. But for me, if you look at our own data, permanent fixation, if you're going to put mesh against the peritoneum, I think is important. Now, extra peritoneal, like, you know, you get someone like Igor Belyinsky at Anne Arundel Hospital, who is, and I would just say out loud, that guy's a surgical unicorn. He is an amazing surgeon. And so he can dissect that space robotically or laparoscopically, do a robotic TAR, laparoscopic TAR, and place the mesh directly against the fascia with a closed peritoneum against the intestine with very wide overlap. Now, does glue or absorbable sutures and fewer sutures and fewer fixation, less fixation work? I will say it makes sense. But in the same breath, I will also say that we have no data. And so if my mesh, and again, I can break it down as an, you know, I don't want to sound like an old, you know, the old man get off my lawn, you know, hernia surgeon, but I will say if my mesh stays where I put it, what's my recurrence rate? It should be about zero. And so you can expand your abdomen 2 to 1, and I want my mesh to stay fixed to that abdomen. But if you have glue or something that goes away that holds the mesh there until the mesh is fully fixated, you would expect that the mesh doesn't stretch, your abdomen does. And so until I have data, and again, you get people like Igor Belyinsky and Conrad Ballister, those guys are they're fantastic surgeons, but and they're following their data, but until I commit to this, I need to see their long-term information.
Great. Well, let's loop Dr. Tettleman into the conversation here. She runs the Comprehensive Hernia Program at the University of Michigan. What is your approach to these large hernias at Michigan? Are you guys using the preperitoneal approach? And how are you guys incorporating robotics into your repairs?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege to be here with Dr. Henneford and all of you. So thank you again. I follow a lot of the similar guidelines that Dr. Henneford does in terms of minimally invasive versus open repair. To be quite honest with you, I'm not doing a preperitoneal approach. I do a retromuscular approach, but I do agree that sometimes, you know, the overlap is a little bit underwhelming because really even with the best job with a retromuscular, unless you're adding a posterior component, you're only getting 15 to 20 centimeter diameter across. And when you have somebody with a very rotund abdomen or somebody who puts more mesh, you know, weight in the middle, I do worry a little bit about that overlap in that space. But again, you don't want to end up doing components on everybody either. In terms of robotics, you know, I'll tell you, we haven't adopted that at Michigan as much. And I think mainly because I'm a bit skeptical, I think, as Dr. Henneford said, about what are A, our long-term outcomes, and B, what problem are sometimes we trying to solve? And while Igor and Conrad do a beautiful job, you know, you have to wonder if the extra expense and the cost and what our responsibility is also in the healthcare system, because I believe the only data that is on robotic hernia repair, which comes from the AHSQC, showed the big savings was maybe half a day or a day to hospital stay, but you wonder, does that really justify the cost? And so unless we're seeing recurrence rates that are really down at 5 to 10 years, patient reported outcomes, which are really stellar, again, I deal with a very kind of funneled in population who are looking for cosmetic results too. And I've just found, especially with these retromuscular approaches, that we don't get the skin infection, we don't get the infection rate, you know, to the same rate we have before. And I really just haven't seen a downside or a replacement for robotic surgery for that yet.
So moving on to just patient selection, what do both of you use as far as exclusion criteria, especially when we're talking about smokers or patients who are morbidly obese? Is there a BMI cutoff as far as especially these reoperative hernias where, you know, they're having complications, they need some sort of operation, but again, they have these comorbidities?
So I think there's two ways to fix outcomes. One, you choose better patients, and two, you do a better technique. And I think for hernia, patient selection is extraordinarily important. When we looked at our data across the Michigan Surgical Quality Collaborative, because we're fortunate to have a statewide collaborative that captures population-based data, what we saw was that people who have class 2 obesity, whose body mass index is 40 or greater, insulin-dependent diabetics, are much, much more likely to have issues, at least in the 30-day perioperative period, and we're looking into it more long-term. So for a purely elective repair, one of the initiatives we have right now is around prehabilitation and patient appropriateness and selection, and not saying no to patients, but working with our patients to get them to surgery. So I think putting guardrails up and saying, okay, we're not going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z is fine. But I think out of the other mouth is you have to have programs that help these patients, that follow these patients, that give these patients opportunity. And that's what we've set up at Michigan, where we have a prehabilitation clinic. We track them, we follow them, we help them with weight loss, referral to bariatric programs, smoking cessation, and keep an eye on them to make sure that an elective situation isn't turning urgent or emergent.
I think that's so beautifully stated. It really is quite remarkable. We've talked about prehabilitation for a long time, and we put out our CEDAR app. And I gave grand rounds at an institution at university last month, and they looked at our CEDAR app. And in that, we looked at 501 of our patients, 1.3 million data points. And the CEDAR app's been out for, I guess, about almost 6 years now, 5.5 years or so. And in that data, you know, we demonstrated, and it's my data with Kent Kircher's data, one of my partners for almost 20 years now, we looked at our diet, you know, where we could make a difference, and we can make a difference with diabetes and weight loss and smoking. It sounds, and right now it sounds like, well, duh, but for a long time, you know, we had patients who would come in, we'd pat them on the head, tell them their diabetes is under control, please stop smoking, we'd send them out, we'd operate on them. We now know that if you want to make real change in the way you take care of patients, and not just hernia patients, but all major operations and even some minor operations, is starting with the patient. First and foremost, that will improve your care out of the gate. You learn nothing new technically. You're the same surgeon. Your prehabilitation is the way to go. And when I gave that grand rounds, one of the students was like looking through the CEDAR app, and she goes, wow, you can get really high complication rates. And I said, well, yeah, those were my patients. But what we've learned is that we have to do better. And as we've tracked our patients over the last 18 years, since we've had a prospective database, you know, we stopped doing smoking in 2006. And if you look at the paper that we're talking about today, smoking fell out in the overall complication rate because we stopped operating on smokers. And then wow. It says they were smoking, but we had them, but they had to stop. So now we've eliminated that as a risk factor. We now, our most recent data you know, if we get a diabetes, they got to get their hemoglobin A1C less than 7.2. We're not doing an open operation for them. And then weight loss, and I think Dr. Tellum is right. You know, BMI of 40 is a real cutoff point. But for us, every point of BMI that you decrease down to a BMI of 26, so 25, why not 25? Well, our data broke at 26. You'll decrease your chance of wound complications by 1.06 times. And for every point of BMI, we save about $3,000 in wound-related complications over a year. And so it becomes super expensive. So why BMI of 40? I mean, if someone's got a BMI of 35 in my clinic, I want them to lose weight. A BMI of 32, I want them to lose weight because I want to squeeze my margins as hard as I can. So weight loss, absolutely. And this rolls into also like in the operating room, the things that happen in the operating room that directly impact our outcomes and improve, you know, cost and taking care of patients, no question. And so
we have to supports to help meet these goals of treating the diabetes and the weight loss. Because like you said, it's easy to say these things, but you really have to have a team that kind of drives this.
There's no question. And initially it fell to the surgeons at the Carolinas Medical Center. We do have a plan to open a preoperative clinic so patients can walk from our office to another office. And that's the intent, that they can get medical care and get support and have a dynamic back and forth. You know, you have family either interacting with their family doctors or internal medicine doctors or nurse practitioners to help them achieve their goals. I think that the one thing they have in Michigan, and I give tremendous respect to what they do in tracking these patients and staying up with these patients, because you can say go out, lose weight, stop smoking, get your diabetes under control, and we'll operate on you. But one of the things that the paper that we just presented at the American Hernia Society, and Katie Schlosser, one of our fellows, won the National Research Award from the America's Hernia Society, is that if you track these patients over time, their hernias continue to get larger, the defect itself gets larger, and also the hernia volume gets larger. So you do have a finite length of time that these patients can get themselves ready for surgery and still affect a good hernia repair. I've not myself ever put myself under constraints to say, you know, over the next 18 months, on average, the patients would increase their defect size by 80 square centimeters. And so now I feel a bit, you know, especially with slightly larger hernias, moderate sized hernias, I feel more pressure if I'm going to be a good doctor and a good surgeon to impact these patients, you know, contract their internal medicine doctor, their family doctor to help me get them ready for surgery and their rehabilitation and then operate on them.
I'll tell you, one of the most effective things that we did was creating this clinic where we pre-screen patients when they call in for areas that we know that are risk factors, BMI, smoking status, and diabetes, and even older adults over a certain age. And simultaneously with my clinic, we have what I call the prehabilitation clinic, which is run by my amazing advanced practice provider. So if she needs my help or something happens, I can pop my head in. But essentially, what we need to do and what I do is we loop in these patients so that they feel like they have a home, they feel they have somewhere to go to. And I think the other nice thing about my second hat being a bariatric surgeon, it's very comfortable for me to talk to people about weight loss and kind of where to go and how to stage these things. And, you know, we're in year one of our program, and just anecdotally kind of starting to look at the data, we can get people through this, and we've had a pretty good smoking cessation rate. We've had a good conversion to bariatric surgery rate. But I think as I was saying before, the key thing is we kept these people in house and kept them a home, which keeps people out of the ER and keeps people out of trouble. And to me, that was the rewarding part, that at least people felt cared for, instead of when you kind of just shut them up and say, you know, good luck and give them a pat on the back and they just sort of run out into the world. So hopefully we'll have data by the next America's Hernia Society about the impact on patient care and eventual conversion to operations.
You can see why I love to hear Dr. Tellum give a lecture about how to take care of patients. This is like real world, the way to take care of people. Give them a home. Don't make them feel as if, you know, they have to go out and do this on their own. I mean, this is the way you take care of people. And it's just fantastic.
Great advice.
Now, moving on to two words, component separation.
We see that this is increasing in popularity, and you mentioned using all three approaches to component separation when you are unable to bring the fascia together. Could you explain how you go about doing each of these from the preperitoneal space, and which component separation is best in which in what situation?
Well, certainly that. I think that when I see a patient in clinic, component separation begins in the clinic. When I see someone in clinic who's got a large defect, has a large hernia volume as well, the what's outside their abdomen versus inside their abdomen, the people who are going to need a component separation in our hands, in the more than 50% of people who have a 150 square centimeter defect, and especially in patients who have greater than 50% of their volume of their abdomen is outside. When you look at a CAT scan versus inside, we do volumetrics on these folks. Those people have a higher chance of complication, going to need a component separation. And the first thing that we do in these folks is weight loss. The way, and I talk very simply to the patients, is the consideration of the way to get it. I mean, just talk about like getting a suitcase closed. What you got so much on the outside, I got to put everything on the inside and I got to get the suitcase closed. Now, if you pull out a pair of jeans and a sweater and your sneakers, now you can latch the suitcase pretty easily. So weight loss plays a big role in this. I will tell you in some of the study that we've just done, weight loss in men, if you only get 5 kilograms of weight loss in a man, it means more for hernia volume and also getting their abdomen closed than it does in women, just because of distribution of fat. And so women can do it. They just have to lose a bit more weight. But we do weight loss. We try to avoid a component separation if we can. And so if I will use weight loss to get someone to a point where our component separation will close their abdomen. If someone needs a component separation, I want to do weight loss to the point that they don't need a component separation. So I want everyone to buy in and lose weight one way or another. In the operating room, I listen to surgeons who will say, I closed a 30 centimeter defect with a tar or an external oblique release. I think what we really need to do, if we're gonna really talk about component separation, what we do is we do the adhesive lysis to the abdominal wall, we reduce the intestine inside the abdomen, and then we put tension on the abdominal wall with Kokers, and then we measure what the defect size is. And then we make decisions about what we're gonna do as far as component separation. I have all component separations in my bag. I don't walk into the OR most of the time knowing what I'm going to do, except in extreme cases. And so I start by putting tension on the abdominal wall. If I can't close them, the first thing that we're going to do is do a cut the posterior sheath on one side or both sides. And I've had a number of surgeons who will watch us operate that say that cutting the posterior sheath doesn't give you release in the abdominal wall. It absolutely does. The majority of the release that you get from a tar, from a transverse abdominis release, comes from cutting the posterior sheath. When you go back and you cut the posterior lamella, the internal oblique, and the transversalis muscle, you get very little release from both of those. So cutting the posterior sheath, I'll cut one side, then the other, and then I reassess, or both. And if I've got a defect at that point with the intestine reduced and I've got a defect that's got more than a 4 centimeter or so gap, what I will then do is I'll do an external oblique release. I do a vessel sparing external oblique release, the perforating vessels that come from the deep epigastrics, periumbilical perforators, 2 centimeters above to 5 centimeters below is where the umbilicus is where you tend to find those vessels. I will spare them and I'll do an external oblique release on one side. If I can close the abdomen, then I'm done. My mesh goes in. For me, my mesh goes in preperitoneally. I've taken the preperitoneal space down and I've closed it, and then I'm done. If I have to do an external oblique release on the other side, then I will do that. When I do a tar, most often it's because if I've got significant scarring of the undersurface of the abdominal wall and I don't need an external oblique release. And because if I can't take the peritoneum down effectively, I try to put my mesh in the preperitoneal space, or an extra peritoneal space. So it would be retrorectus and preperitoneal as it extends laterally with a transverse abdominis release. Doing a transverse abdominis release, for the most part, the way I first just, and Yuri Novitsky deserves great props for describing this and really, really technically defining it. When we first started doing an operation like this, we published it in 2006. And essentially what I called it was the extension, the preperitoneal extension of a stoper repair. because I just didn't think I got much release by cutting through the posterior lamella, the internal oblique, and the transverse abdominis muscle. And so for the most part, when I'm doing a component separation, it's the walkthrough of reducing, deciding, you know, cutting the posterior sheath. Do I need an external oblique? Will a TAR help me? And then closing the abdomen after mesh placement.
That's fascinating. And it's great to hear, you know, how you might use each approach to its own unique advantage. To start wrapping up, I heard anecdotally about a few interesting aspects of your technique and what you're doing at Carolinas. Can you tell us and our listeners about your use of Botox injections to bring the fascia together?
Sure. It's interesting. We presented this at the Central Surgical. Sean Maloney, one of our residents who's working in our lab this year, he looked at 775 of our component separations. And it's just much a product of Dr. Tellum's practice and my practice. And I love it. I stand at the bottom of the funnel and, you know, putting Humpty Dumpty back together again makes me really happy. And I'm glad that there's residents and fellows who have interest in this. But as far as when we do component separations, I mentioned earlier, weight loss is always part of the way we trying to prevent component separation. If I could not do external oblique releases, it would improve my outcomes because of wound-related complications. I love to hear Dr. Tellum's point on this, but wound-related complications because of the skin and subcutaneous tissue advancement that's required, or the flap development that's required. And so one of the things that we do know is that, so maybe just thinking about it, maybe we should eliminate external oblique release and just bridge patients because of the wound complications. Well, in the data that we presented at the Central Surgical, and I have a paper coming out in Surgery, if we didn't get the fascia together, our hernia recurrence rate was dramatically higher, 5 times higher in these patients than if we did a component separation. Component separation was actually protective for hernia recurrence. So in an effort to reduce the external need for external oblique release and to actually cut someone was walking around with one of their three external obliques or their oblique muscles cut for the rest of their life, what we started using is Botox. We put it through its paces. It's been well described. The guys in Guadalajara, Mexico first described it in 2009, and they deserve lots of credit. A surgeon in Sydney, Australia, has Nabil Ibrahim, has done great work looking at CAT scans and looking at the release that you get. It's a chemical paralysis of the obliques to allow you to get the abdomen closed. And so what they've shown in Guadalajara and in Sydney is that if you inject all three obliques, typically we use 300 units of Botox, you inject them in three different places, typically in the anterior axillary line, 150 units on each side, evenly divided, that you get somewhere between 5.5 to 8 centimeters of release of the abdominal wall, flattening and thinning of the obliques, which have contracted back. The volume of the hernia has actually decreased it, so you get more intestinal on the inside of the abdomen. And what we've seen in our initial patients is that we use it in fistula patients with big defects, mesh infections with big defects, and we saw, I'm just going to tell you, Botox works. And now what we're trying to do in our practice is eliminate external oblique release, decrease wound-related complications, save money, and perhaps afford patients getting fascial closure and sparing their obliques. It's new. It's relatively new. It's been around for about 10 years, but it's relatively new in North America. There are selected centers who are spending some time with it. But in our first patients now, we've now done about 90 patients. In our first 90 patients, we've been extremely pleased with it.
So with that Botox, though, do you have to do, I guess, repeat injections? Because I would imagine that it's going to just put tension once the Botox has worn off. So do you have to continuously inject the Botox until everything's healed?
I think that's a great question. We inject it about 4 weeks prior to surgery. And again, I'll just say that we're mimicking others' success. We have not done our own individual experiments looking at different doses of Botox, different timing of using Botox. We're actually putting it through its paces with known evidence. And so we'll inject it 4 weeks before. We get a great effect and a lengthening of the obliques in these patients. And what will end up happening is that one of the cool things about this, it's almost like a party trick, is that their abdomens will, once you put them back together again, they look great when they leave the hospital. Our average length of stay is about 5.5 days. They come back at 2.5 weeks. And their abdomen has expanded. the Botox continues to work and the muscles relax you. And I can make up all kinds of answers and sound authoritative, but there's no question. I believe that you take tension off the midline closure, which may be protective. I have no idea. Maybe it's protective. But then in about 3 months, their muscles will come back online and their abdomens tighten back up again. But what we've seen is they don't over tighten. It's much like if someone gains a lot of weight and then loses a lot of weight and they come back to a steady state, or you take someone who is pregnant, has a baby, and then their muscles come back online and they pull their abdomen back to a normal set of tension. And so we've not had patients who complain of an overly tight abdomen, who pull their abdomen apart and that sort of thing. They come back to a natural state of tension in their abdominal wall.
Well, Dr. Hinneford, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us on Behind the Knife, and we appreciate your efforts in continually improving hernia care throughout this country. And I was wondering, is there any videos on YouTube or something we could provide our listeners so they could get a good visualization of this? I feel like that is a lot of this is being able to visualize it.
I'll tell you, I have not done that, but I will do that for you. And then I can let you know. We can make a video and do a total preperitoneal dissection and then make it available to you.
We could actually post it where they could watch it on their phone, just directly like on iTunes. It would share it as like a podcast. It'd be pretty cool, like a video cast. But thank you again for all your work. And thank you, Dr. Tellum, for helping us understand how to improve outcomes in hernia care. And I know our listeners will enjoy reading this paper when it's published in the Annals of Surgery.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex L.
I'm Libby Delena. Welcome
to This Morning Walk podcast.
We started this show because after our morning walks, we would connect and have a conversation. And the things that we were seeing, smelling, learning might be really interesting for someone else to hear.
We are so excited that This Morning Walk podcast has joined Blind Nil Audio, a new podcast network from executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines.
Follow, share, and listen to This Morning Walk podcast
wherever you get your podcasts.